You want to take us back, actually, however many years to sort of what was the original inspiration for guardrails, and also sort of how that vision has evolved over time as sort of the landscape has changed and things like that.
Yeah, absolutely. So guardrails, we are in July of 2024, and guardrails, the open source was released in March of 2023. And the company, started soon after, and then I'd been working on the open source for, some while before. And the idea honestly stems from a lot of the years that I spent in the self-driving industry, and all of the massive kind of like Sisyphean task it was to get self-driving to a reliable enough place where Waymo, for example, drive, without any driver in the driver's seat in San Francisco. So, a lot of the reliability tooling that we have to build, a lot of the mindset shift that we had to kind of adopt in the self-driving space, bringing all of those techniques to generative AI, which is something that I kind of anticipated we need. That was the initial motivation. I was, like somebody who'd been working in AI my entire life, and so when around when the fever pitch for building AI applications with, a lot of LLM endpoints was reaching its frenzy. A lot of honestly, a lot of awesome work by you, Logan. I was part of that excitement, and I kind of like realized what it would take to get a lot of the applications we're building that people were building from like this POC stage to very production ready, consistently drives a lot of value to almost its finished level of like Apple-like products that we're used to seeing, right? And I knew that we need a lot of the reliability tooling in order to get there, and guardrails started as a form of like building that in the open
I
source.
love that. Has anything sort of diverged from any of the initial hypotheses that you had about like what people would need to get to production? I feel like at least my perspective is the ground hasn't shifted tremendously, but I feel like there's still a lot of like nuance and stuff that people have picked up over the last couple of years now.
Yeah, I think the two things that come to mind immediately. The first is that there's this deeper understanding of what are the new architectures and pieces of infrastructure we need to add reliability. Right? Like I remember when I started, and I would constantly get these questions of like, oh, are you a monitoring tool? Or are you, an evaluation platform? Like what is guardrails, or how do we think about guardrails? And I would talk about, no, it's something that, it's a sidecar that works with your LLM, and it explicitly does validation and verification of everything that you send. And it's primarily because, LLMs are unreliable. And so this adds that layer of, extra reliability, extra verification. And everybody would kind of like have a hard time like wrapping around what that was, because there's not really a concept that maps to traditional software. And that's because traditional software is deterministic, right? And so we didn't need infrastructure like this in traditional software. So one of the big pieces that I've seen like shift from then to now is that way more people understand, what is this idea of AI validation, why we need it, and why it's really important. So a year out from now, I would like guardrails, all of these like market maps and infrastructure maps that are created, like guardrails would get kind of like squished in with evaluation, et cetera. And I think now, it's its own category typically around AI validation that we're part of. That is one big update that I've seen. I think the second is just really this understanding of like AI development is very much like traditional software development, in the sense that, you need to have, there's like components and frameworks that will be consistent and that you can rely on to help guide you, like how to build your, how to design your system architecture. But at the end of the day, it is like software development in the sense of you have to iterate many different times, identify what are the unique problems to you, and then build according to that. And then if you look at, like the standard RAG pipeline, if you just try picking it off the shelf and using it, yes, you'll get a great demo, great POC off the ground, but it typically won't be at the point where, you can like ship it in a core part of your application and expect it to work amazingly for your specific domain. So I think that's an understanding that people have, come to have a lot more of now, which was, I think like different from before.
Where do you think we are in sort of that understanding curve? My intuition is like there's still a lot of people who have yet to wrap their head around just how much like last mile work is required to get one of these applications into production. I think people still just like they see the demo and they're like, oh great, this is going to be a couple lines of code and we're good to go ship it. And I feel like reality is actually much different.
Yeah, for sure. I think it's kind of like the question that I feel very fortunate that because we'd seen this pattern in machine learning so many times over and over again, where, you know, something gets solved in research or something gets solved in like in an independent, like sandboxy environment. And then immediately the expectation is that we'll be able to pick this up and just, you know, apply it everywhere. And I've just been through that cycle enough times to know that this is not how it works. You know, the last, always the problem with machine learning is the long tail, right? And the long tail is just so brutal. This is like what is so painful about self-driving. And this is what, you know, I would spend a lot of my time trying to solve in self-driving. And it's also what is like really hard to capture in generative AI, which is that you can solve for the average case like really well, and you'll ask a question and, you know, get a very reasonable sounding answer. But people are weird and very unique and have very different interpretations, and, you know, will come to interact with your AI system in very, very unique ways. And you need to design for that whole wide spectrum of users, right? So in this, like in that understanding, I think like people are at different levels of, I think the people that are very close to machine learning and understand the fundamentals of machine learning, like really to their core understand that. But it, you know, I think like the moment that we're in with AI is that it really has become mainstream to a degree where, you know, my mom was just like flying to the US, and then my cousin, who very, very traditional, does not work in AI at all, was like, oh, you should download this thing called ChatGPT, and, you know, it'll be helpful for your travels, right? A year and a half on out, or however much time it's been. So I think like there's this whole sort of people where like AI has really transcended this very small technical community to like the broader consciousness. And like there, that group of people, like this understanding of what it takes to rely on and trust an AI system, is still nascent. I think that's what worries me a little as well, which is that people don't understand, like when they interact with this technology, they don't really understand like what the nuances are of when you should trust something, or, you know, how do you use it to make decisions, right? Like how do you talk to it, and what is its intended use, and what it's not, what is outside of its scope, etc. I think like that's an area where I feel like there's a lot more understanding left. Even in terms of application builders, I feel like people are very quickly maturing in understanding how to build more reliable AI systems, but it's still, you know, depending on your risk profile, depending on your familiarity with the tools before, you know, it's an entire spectrum because of how popular AI has become.
I think question based off that as well, and maybe you answered it, but I'm curious as to the buy-in from an organizational standpoint for Guardrails AI. You know, it seems like having an extra layer of security is an easy yes, but I guess, you know, challenges, and does it come back to kind of the educational aspect you just spoke about, but I guess challenges as far as introducing this platform or technology to some of those folks.
Yeah, I think like that's the interesting thing where like organizations love us, honestly. I think like indie developers, you know, tend to be like, oh, I'm just building a POC. Why do I need this? You know, and then why is this important if I just want to show initial value? And the truth is you don't. Like if you're just building an initial POC, you don't need something like Guardrails. But yeah, organizations, every time I talk to, you know, like senior leadership, etc., they're all really excited, and they really see the value because they tend to be more risk averse by definition. And, you know, they want to solve for the long tail and want to solve for, you know, all of the ways that this can go wrong and be more harmful than it is helpful. So they, you know, immediately kind of grok the value. And a lot of what they think about is that, let's say I'm a financial institution, right? So what are the set of criteria? What does my risk profile look like to different types of AI failure cases? So for example, if there's PII leakage versus, you know, if I have like a chatbot that communicates in a way that's not in line with my, you know, comms guidelines, right? Versus a more consumer-facing technology where like, or a consumer-facing company where branding is everything. So PII leakage, like important, but not to the level that, you know, like brand guidelines being violated are, right? And so that risk profile of who's sensitive to what is very, very varied. So based on that, I think like that is typically the question that they have, et cetera. And that's also the reservation that they have about like Gen AI adoption a lot of times. And that's something where we come in and, you know, we tell them like, if this is the problem that you have, here's how to think about it. And once again, you know, the technology is fundamentally new. AI validation as a concept is new to people, and there's not a parallel that they can really draw in, you know, the traditional software world. So there is a level of like education that's involved there. But once they are educated on that, they're typically like really excited about it.
I love the analogies of all the self-driving car stuff. And we'll talk more about it in the next few minutes. But I'm also curious, like, why not try to solve part of this problem, like at the model layer? Like you're sort of doing the sidecar, the model's been trained, it's sort of has these behaviors that are part of it. Is there any level, or do you have any expectation that you'll like push upstream or downstream, depending on the analogy, to try to like help make the models not have some of these behaviors to begin with?
Yeah. So for sure, you know, like the one core thing to remember is that like guardrails aren't a fix-all for reliability. Like they help work in tandem with a lot of other solutions to add reliability, right? And then whenever people ask me that question, I'm like, yeah, sure, like go ahead and, you know, train your models as much as possible to, you know, disincentivize or incentivize a lot of the behaviors that you care about. Typically, what you'll find is it's really, really expensive to train, not just in terms of, you know, the actual compute and infrastructure, but also data, right? Like data is what was challenging about machine learning for the longest time. One of the big, big, big enablers of generative AI is that you don't need data. What you needed, you know, a lot of data and then train a model and then ship the model, apply it, etc. All of that gets circumvented. In favor of a prompt, right? So you don't need data anymore. As long as you have a prompt and like few short examples, you're typically okay. And then if you're asking people to like fine tune the model, you're really like putting the burden back on them on a problem that they might not have, you know, enough information on. So guardrails are a way that in a like data free way, you know, like we have small language models or, you know, like small classifiers, etc., that spike on specific types of bad behaviors. Like, is there PII leakage, or is there, you know, like mentions of a competitor, or is there, you know, conversation about a topic that you don't want to talk about? And then, you know, those things get flagged, right? So doing that, like, one of my favorite phrases is that you don't really need a jackhammer to crack open like a walnut. You can do it with like a much smaller tool. And so, you know, if you want to catch and prevent like these types of behaviors, you can create a massive data set and then update, you know, this like trillion parameter model to disincentivize that behavior. But typically you'll find more success, you know, using like traditional smaller models. And this also kind of like, this is not a novel concept in machine learning, right? Like this ties into a lot of what we've seen in machine learning for years with the idea of like ensembling and, you know, verification, et cetera, right? So it like we don't have to kind of like reinvent the wheel completely from scratch because we can, you know, key into a lot of these successful patterns that we've seen in the past.
I guess something that stuck out to me too in doing some research, and I'm in the open source space, so I was very interested to learn more. But obviously with Guardrails Hub, which offers, you know, open source collection of kind of AI validation models, I guess I'm curious, how important is the open source community in advancing the goals of Guardrails AI? And then more broadly, how is the open source community important in the safe development of AI?
Yeah, I think that's a really great question. I think for us, being open source, you know, is a very, very key part of our DNA. And it's something that is very core to our, you know, it's very core to the work that we do. A lot of our advancements, a lot of like how we think about, you know, solving in this problem space is all done in a very open manner. And we end up seeing the community give this back to us as well. So a lot of our even adoption in like very large enterprises comes from, you know, folks that heard about or learned about guardrails from the open source community and then, you know, got excited about like what this can mean for the problems that they're doing there. So it's a very like symbiotic system. And then, you know, a lot of these organizations are then really excited about contributing back to the hub, a lot of the guardrails that they've kind of like built out and stuff. So it ends up being like pretty positive. Even within open source, there's like these gradients, you know, not all open source, like not everything open source is not like equally permissive, but we've made a huge effort where we strive to be like super, super permissive. With respect to like safe and reliable AI development, I think this is something I actually think about a lot. I was on a panel just last week about how to think about regulating AI and like the risks that, you know, come from a lot of like AI failures. And I think the one thing that kind of gives me pause is that it's the risks that are like, you know, generative AI systems just make like AI, like information possible in a manner that it wasn't before to like very, very, that to people, you know, that might not have a lot of context on how to solve this problem, right? So concretely, the positive side of it is that many people who might not have been programmers now find a very easy on-ramp to learn programming or learn a new skill that helps them in their work. The flip side of this is that if you are a malicious user with like malicious intent, then it's very easy for you to like start learning how to, you know, maybe start manufacturing harmful chemicals or something, you know, in a manner that would be like much harder for you to do if you did not have access to these systems. And this is something that, you know, a lot of the regulation has like come about, and a lot of, you know, there's most model companies, you know, have a lot of red teaming and testing that helps prevent that. In terms of open source, I think like the way open source helps is that the right architecture for how to build to prevent those harms at the system level, not at the model level, get disseminated much more widely because of open source, right? So if there's these harms that you're worried about, if you were to do this in a completely isolated manner in an organization, you'd typically struggle, you know, if it wasn't for open source, and you try to figure out like, okay, you'd have a lot of iteration to try to figure out like what a good design pattern is. But because of the open source, you know, you can kind of like key into patterns that other people have had success with, and, you know, just have an easy kind of like starting point. So that's how it's helpful. But I think this is kind of like one of the big questions of our time, which is, and I can see like arguments on both sides, and I'd say it's a much longer conversation.
And I guess another quick question off that, and I think they kind of flow hand in hand. So I guess in this space currently, how are you combating or staying ahead as far as, you know, giving Guardrails AI a competitive advantage, a competitive moat? Again, you kind of go back to the fact that there is a lot of this being open sourced, you know, this day and age, just with the sheer amount of organizations that are coming about. You know, how do you kind of, like I said, prioritize keeping that advantage while also making sure that you are keeping things open and kind of staying along true and true with that kind of thesis?
So I generally think that open source is our competitive advantage. I think we see this a lot, right? Like we're not a not-for-profit company. Like we are, we do care about, you know, making money, but typically we end up seeing that even like I mentioned earlier, even within organizations, we have a much easier time getting into organizations because people have used and have gotten value out of the open source. So that really ends up being our competitive advantage, you know, the hub and the people, you know, that get value out of and then contribute back to the hub, et cetera, typically ends up being like where we're at. I think the other place that we've seen like work out very well for us is our roots in machine learning and in high risk machine learning systems. So I talked about self-driving, you know, and Guardrails as a product was very early when most people were like, oh, I just want to kind of, you know, play around with these systems, right? I just want to see what's possible. And Guardrails came on the scene and talked about like, hey, it's almost like people talked about this philosophical idea for guardrailing a lot. And it was like, okay, here's what this really means in code format, right? Like if you were to take this philosophical concept and like make an engineering system out of it. And so I think a lot of that, like I said, comes from having very deep machine learning roots that we just get to like use and apply. So there's a lot of other things that we're releasing pretty soon that I'm pretty excited about that, you know, are going to keep furthering that mission.
Yeah, this conversation about the how related potentially the risk profiles are of self-driving cars and what you're doing now with Guardrails is actually a really interesting. It was like from one really horribly difficult problem to the next. I feel like the consequences of getting something wrong in the world of self-driving is like probably similar to the world of Guardrails for you now. And I'm curious like how that's influenced, you know, the way that you operate and the way that the company has been built, et cetera, et cetera. Like, is there anything like weird and unique that you've had to do because of like, even though you're a software business, like you're not doing self-driving, you still have to sort of do some of the things that you were doing in your previous life?
Oh, that's such a great question. I think one thing I'll say is that the risks are a little bit different, or at least a little bit on different levels. With self-driving, you know, there's like this physical system, you know, heavy machinery that's operating on the road that can be very dangerous. There are a lot of failure modes of generative AI, but right now they're limited to embarrassing stuff happening for organizations that people take Twitter screenshots off and, you know, share, which is, you know, for brand conscious organizations, like, very important and can lead to, like, regulatory failures. As we've seen, the ChatGPT lawyer is probably one of the most famous, you know, like, failure cases. I think, like, in terms of what that means for us, yeah, that's a great question. I would say I just have a fundamental level of, like, skepticism in terms of whenever I look at, like, technology, in terms of what's possible, because I just know that, like, once again, the long tail, I keep coming back to it, and the long tail to capture ends up being really hard, right? So every time I think I see a demo, I'm always thinking about, like, okay, where does this fail? And what would it take to make it not fail at that level? And, you know, it's like, it's a weird position to be in, because I am, like, I am very bullish on AI. I love AI. I love, you know, making it very exciting. But I know that in order to get the maximum value out of it, you need to, you know, make it work as reliably as, you know, I don't know, like something boring, like a database system. Database systems are great, but they're not as exciting as AI. So I think you'd need to, you know, like, build enough, like, level of reliability, you know, the many nines of reliability for AI applications. And that's what I kind of think about. I think one of my favorite self-driving pieces of trivia, that it's something that people find interesting, which is that if you think about the average case for self-driving, right, it's driving straight on a highway, constant speed, and, you know, not speeding, not turning, right? And something as simple as that, like, most driving data is typically something like that. It's not all the weird fancy maneuvers, right? And that problem was solved, like, by most self-driving car companies a while ago. Like, that's not why we're not seeing, like, greater adoption of self-driving. All of the risks of self-driving are in all of the weird, like, corner cases where somebody's, you know, accelerating in this weird manner and needs to kind of, like, catch up right in time, etc. You know, that's where a lot of the failure modes happen. And that level of, like, thinking deeply about the system is, like, what we'll need for generative AI as well.
Yeah, I'm coming up with a bunch of parallels to self-driving now. One of them is, I'm curious, like, from an adoption perspective, if you think this will, like, I feel like there was a, you know, Waymo had self-driving demos, you know, more than 10 years ago, but ultimately, like, to get to the point that Waymo's at now, where it's, like, actually being used ubiquitously and you can access it in San Francisco, there's no wait list. Like, that was in a lot of last mile work to make that happen. Do you think there's any similarity with, and maybe it's, like, a much accelerated timeline from, like, the demo to production use case, but do you think we're, like, still some order of many years away from, like, LLMs being, like, ubiquitous across, like, every application and domain? And do you think it's going to be, like, the same safety type of things that stop that from happening? Or it's just, like, maybe, like, a fundamental lack of usefulness or something?
Oh, that's such a wonderful question. I think we are some years away, but I think it'll be a much more condensed, like, shrunken timeline compared to what the timeline has been for self-driving cars. And I do think that, I think it's basically going to be, like, two key problems. One is the reliability problem, which is, you know, like, edge cases, failure modes, and, like, building fail safes, building reliable infrastructure for AI systems. And that's the problem I'm really focused on and I care a lot about. And I think that will be one thing that's kind of, like, stopping reliable AI adoption. I think the second problem would be, I wouldn't call it usefulness, but I will call it, I'll think about it more from, like, interface design, you know. If you think about, like, the AI applications that have been most successful, in my opinion, there's two. I think there's, like, you know, AI chat assistants or ChatGPT or, you know, what have you. And I think the second one is copilots, you know. And that's the sum total of where the most value up until now has been accrued. And both of those allow for a level of, like, fallibility of the AI system, right? Which is a great, like, sign of how good the interface needs to be or how the interface needs to capture AI failure mode. So, for example, if your AI chatbot fails, you know, you can say, oh, no, this is what I meant, or this is why your answer is not helpful. I mean, the model obviously needs to be good, right? Like, you'll try it a few times, and if it doesn't work, you know, you're maybe going to give up and, like, go away. But it allows for this feedback where the model can fail and you can give it, you know, update and get something that's correct. Same with Copilot. Like, Copilot, you start with a suggestion. If it's wrong, you just discard it, right? So I think we do need to think about, like, what are the, rather than shoehorning AI into everything, like, you have some web interface that you ask, like, suddenly we have this web interface, and instead of, you know, clicking around on it, you can also suddenly chat with it. Right? I don't think that is as valuable as really thinking about what is the task that someone wants to do, or what is someone's like core value objective, and then how can we solve for that value objective, not by shoehorning AI into an existing system, but like building from scratch. And so I think that to me boils down to an interface design problem. So I think reliability and interfaces, and the same pattern happened in self-driving cars. Reliability, you know, it's very obvious, and there's so much that goes behind the scenes in making self-driving cars reliable. I have like really fun stories of, the weird stuff that it entails. But even interface design, right? Like if you think about like, if you guys have been inside a Waymo, then, you know, there's so much that goes into like making you, the rider, feel like you have agency, so that when the AI system inevitably messes up, you know, you feel like you have control, which is a key component that we need to kind of like work towards.
I guess switching up slightly, are you able to share any interesting production guardrails use cases as far as how, you know, outcomes that have maybe come or problems that have been stopped based on guardrails AI?
Yeah. It's a great question. I'll talk about like failure modes and like how we prevent those. I think it's almost like it's kind of like the security problem in some sense, right? In that like no news is great news, which is also like what the guardrails AI success stories are. No news is great news. I think like, so yeah, let's see. I think a large fintech company in India and then one of the biggest tech companies globally both released within the last 6 months chatbots, which did not have necessary guardrails to contain your chatbot on topic. So these were supposed to be, you know, chat with, like get help on this specific fintech platform or this specific tech platform. And then because it was unguarded, people were using it as a wrapper around, you know, your favorite LLM. And so do math homework with me, you know, on this fintech company, or help me write Python code, etc. Right? So like some of the guardrails that we like typically recommend in that is like, enforce what you want people to get out of your chatbot, right? It's not like here's this chatbot and it'll write a poem for you and it'll help you, you know, text a message, like draft a message to, that you can send to your girlfriend when you're trying to like, you know, make up for something. But instead, like think about like, okay, you can only ask questions about, you know, my transactions or how do I return my order or how do I change my password? Like enforce what that good behavior intended usage looks like. And then we have guardrails that'll enforce that every request that comes into your system needs to fall into, you know, one of those intended usage. If it doesn't, we, you know, like tell the people that, okay, this is not something that's allowed. I think another big one is hallucination. Again, the failure modes are really, really famous. ChatGPT lawyer is one of the big ones, but you know, there's been so many cases outside of that as well. I think most recently, the city of New York put out this chatbot that, you know, Logan's nodding. So Logan, you know, is familiar with this, but essentially small business users can come onto this chatbot and ask the chatbot questions about, you know, New York City regulation, right? So you don't want to hire a lawyer, and reading legalese is really painful as somebody who runs a company and now has to do this frequently. I can completely concur why a chatbot would be great there. But this chatbot hallucinated. And when you're a small business who's taking advice from an AI system about regulation, hallucinations are really terrible, right? There's a real risk and cost to them. And I think like, so we typically have guardrails that will ground every single utterance from the LLM, so every sentence or even chunk, right, like even smaller than a sentence, into sources that you can then rely on. And then if we can't establish a source, that is when we call something as hallucinated, right? Like it's basically being used from the model's own internal knowledge rather than like from context that you provided. And so that allows you to like flag when something is like false or, you know, unreliable, etc., and allows you to like prevent hallucination. So that's I would say a big use case that people use this for.
That makes a ton of sense. I'm curious, sort of as the stakes continue to ramp up, like I feel like this year with real-time audio, with vision use cases, with video, it feels like the need for guardrails is like continuing to increase. What's your, I feel like a lot of the traditional things, maybe this isn't the case, but like my mental model would be like a lot of the like text-to-text stuff is actually a little bit easier to do some of these guardrails on versus like image or video, especially in like real time where you're streaming and don't have all the context yet. Do you have a sense of like how, is there like a bunch of new technology that needs to be built, or like how are you tackling all of those new emergent problems?
Yeah, it's a great question, and I get asked this a lot as well. I think what's cool about it is that the fundamental framework remains the same, right? Because what you're doing is like, you're taking some policy or some criteria where you're like, this is what I really care about. And I care about this one criteria in this very vast, you know, multi-dimensional space that my input or output can belong to, right? Like, it's when you look at a video, there's so much that's happening in a video, but you're like, this one specific failure mode is what I want to track, right? And that's what a guardrail is. So the cool thing about it is that the fundamental architecture remains the same, which is that on the input or on the output side, you validate what is it that you care about, and is that condition actually happening? And if it happens, what do you want to do about it, right? What changes is detecting when something's happening or not, which is much easier in text, easier, like, you know, there's a scale here. Easier doesn't mean absolutely easy, just relatively. But it's like relatively easier in text, but in video especially, it's really challenging. I used to work on, you know, video, I used to work on like images. And then when I switched over to text, I was like, oh, this is amazing. I don't have to train a model on 64 massive GPUs for a week to then get results. You know, I can just do it like in the small amount of time. So it's, yeah, I think like just the data modality is just so much denser, which makes it harder. I think that's basically what will need to change. The architecture remains the same, but the detectors or the classifiers that power each guardrail will end up looking different. The other thing I want to flag there is that the cool thing about text is that outside of just, you know, that a user can read it or a user can, like, you know, type in it, it's that it acts as an interface between systems, right? So you typically have to like glue together multiple of these AI systems to build an overall like AI application. And then the way that these systems communicate with each other is via text. And so even if, you know, on either end, like the final interface that your final customer interacts with is like different, within the system, you'll still have like text guardrails. So AI agents, for example, AI agents, you know, every agent like communication or, you know, internal call will be text-based, even if on either end you have, you know, like audio or video or image or something. So we still, like, the idea of text-based guardrails is much more, will have much more wider scope than image, video, or audio.
Yeah, in the agentic system situation, have you looked into, like, have people used, like, perhaps more broad guardrails to, like, help guide the behavior of agentic systems? Like, less from, like, I don't want PII to come out, but more from, like, almost I kind of want you to complete this, like, task for me, but, like, don't do these things. Like, I don't want you to call my bank as you try to do X, Y, and Z thing for me or something like that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think like the key to making agents work is with guardrails, honestly. And I think we saw a first iteration of, you know, agents, and then it was agents that, once again, the average case or like a demo case or something would work, but anytime you tried using it, right, it would end up being so brittle. And it's because like you're giving this system just access to the entire, that can do everything under the sun, and you're like, go do this very specific task for me, and it's bound to fail, right? So the way to make it work is to like constrain, like almost have these like bounding boxes of like, hey, this one subsystem or this one, like, you know, executor, I only wanted to do like one of these six set of actions, and all of those actions look like this, right? And then this other system, I wanted to do these other things. And that's the way, like, by drawing these constraints, that you make agents reliable enough. I think like there's a bunch of like new frameworks that I've seen that look much more reliable. And I think if you actually look at, you know, how they're implemented, like they'll implicitly have these like guardrailing behavior, right? Of like, if this is what I'm asking using the LLM for, like take one of these next six actions, this is what those actions should be able to do for me. And if it's doing anything outside of that, don't execute that action, right? So that's on a very high level, that's how you add those constraints.
Do you think that someone would be able to do that? Like, I was just thinking, can that happen automatically? Like, if someone's using guardrails to build an agentic system and like almost define the goal, and then you can have an LLM or some other system, like, you know, go make me 20 guardrails now to make sure that like nothing bad happens as this agent does X, Y, and Z feature for me.
Oh, interesting. Like even the guardrails that are generated automatically, basically. Oh, that's so cool. Not yet, but it's something that would be really awesome to have. I think I'm always worried about the chicken and egg problem. Like at some point, somebody needs to come in and say, okay, this is the source of truth. Like, this is what I can trust, right? And then everything kind of like stems from there. So I am curious about that, but it would be like a, it would be a cool, yeah, project to hack on.
Exclusive product launch right here. Guardrails auto agent creation.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Do you want to talk about something that is upcoming on the roadmap, which is already released by the time this podcast comes out, with Guardrail Server? Do you want to tell us about what it is and all that good stuff?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm really excited about it. So it's not out yet, but it's out tomorrow at the time of recording and will be out when the podcast comes out. So we're launching Guardrail Server, which we're really, really excited about. It's basically allows you to spin up, you know, in three lines of code, you can spin up a dedicated endpoint that will validate any LLM request. And so that allows you to, you know, like have essentially a very, very easy, fast, efficient way to use guardrails and add them to your application. This was the number one ask, like across the board from all of our users, especially teams that are deploying us. And this makes it like very, very easy for you to deploy guardrails within your LLM application. So for example, if you care about, you know, making sure that any LLM access that you're giving within your organization does not contain PII, you can spin up a guardrails endpoint and point it around your LLM so that, you know, rather than querying the LLM, you query the guardrails endpoint and you end up getting like PII free, you know, responses. And like, even if you're sending input with PII, it won't actually get sent to, you know, the model that you're worried about. So you can mix and match and do a lot of things with it, but it just makes it really, really easy to like use guardrails at scale.
I guess kind of question going back to, and even this conversation has strengthened my thought behind, it seems like everyone needs guardrails. It's, again, I find it ironic that people don't. I guess based on that, you know, what would be a roadblock or a hurdle in which you'd have to face in order to actually execute on the fact that all moving forward, whether it's an organization, a large language model, whatever the case is, actually adopts and, you know, brings in those different guardrails. I think, again, just a layer of security and validation is huge, and it's going to solve a lot of issues. And again, I think right now we're in an interesting space because folks who are new to AI, you know, you get one prompt that hallucinates or one thing that goes wrong, and next thing you know, that's all you're thinking about. Back to the point where it's like there's a lot of, you know, no noise can sometimes be good noise. So yeah, I kind of just curious as far as what that would look like or any blockers that you see in the near future.
Yeah, it's such a great question. I think one of the big ones is that, like, essentially, like, each guardrail under the hood is a machine learning model. And how performant is that machine learning model is something, you know, like, not every single problem in the universe can be solved with machine learning, right? But some of them can. And so identifying and being very judicious about how you're using it, I think that's something that I would like basically urge people to think about as they're like adopting guardrails. So we end up getting a lot of like asks about, you know, prompt injection. And we do have a lot of integrations with like whatever the state of the art is today in prompt injection. Like, we provide that on in Guardrails Hub. But prompt injection as a problem is very active area of research and yet unsolved. Like, there's some patterns that we see again and again come up, and you can have detections for those patterns. But, you know, every week almost there's like a new attack that's discovered that, you know, maybe would not be captured from those patterns, right? So for example, like prompt injection, you can solve the known version of that problem with machine learning, but you can't solve prompt injection as a whole with machine learning, right? So, and as a consequence, you can solve like whatever the known version is with guardrails, but not all of it with guardrails. So that's kind of like the thing that is like the limitation, which is that you can only do what's possible with machine learning today.
That makes a ton of sense. We've been talking a bunch about moving back and forth between physical systems and virtual systems. I'm curious, back to the world of physical systems, as like the amount of AI hardware and robotics seems to be really picking up. And it also seems somewhat possible now that like multimodal LLMs might be able to solve like part of the general purpose reasoning robotics problems. Any like interesting, I'm curious, like, if you have, I'm not sure if you can share, if you have customers who are doing those use cases, but like any thoughts around like how all of this actually comes back to like potentially essentially self-driving systems using LLMs, and then how you essentially have to build some of the systems you've built before, but for robots this time, perhaps?
Oh, yeah. Robots. I think whatever I feel about video about like, oh my God, it's so much easier to work in tech. I think it's times 10 in robotics. So I honestly have a huge amount of respect for anybody that works in robotics. I think like, honestly, I think there is a whole set of problems. Like if you're working with similar physical systems that I think LLMs would be able to like help solve. But it's just like, those are just like really, really hard problems, you know, generally. So for example, like there's entire teams within self-driving cars that focus on just calibration, right? Like you'll have, you're solving a problem in software based on, you know, what you sense of the world around you, but you want to make sure that you can actually trust whatever is sensed, right? Like whatever the system kind of like captures for you. And there's teams that are dedicated to just calibrating the signal that you're getting from all of these sensors is the accurate representation of like the world around you. So there's all of these like really, really finicky problems that happen in, in robotics that you kind of like, there's just no way around, like you just have to be somebody that's very familiar with hardware to be able to like solve those problems. I think like one problem that does get easier and that I am excited about is there's this, you know, key problem in robotics around like the sim to real gap. So you try to solve a lot of problems in simulation, but you know, there's, as the name suggests, this gap between whatever you're doing in simulation versus what's happening in the real world. And I think that's an area that I'm curious to see if LLMs can kind of like help build better simulation models that allow, you know, closing that sim to real gap.
I guess this is taking a step back and a little bit higher of a level, but I guess, you know, what advice do you have for listeners or potential co-founders or people working in this space, currently right now, as far as things that you've been able to do or advice that you heard that has led to some of your success in being able to build out a successful company such as Guardrails?
Yeah. I'm happy to share my thoughts here. I think one is that it's an amazing, amazing time to be in AI. I think this is truly one of the biggest technologies of our lifetime. And I can't believe that not only am I alive at this time when this big revolution is happening, but I work in this area and, you know, this is what I studied and this is what I've like been spending my whole career. And so I feel very fortunate to be at this place in this time. So, you know, like really thinking about like, if you don't work in AI, what is the domain that you work in today? And how can automation come augment a lot of the work that you do and, you know, help give you a lot of like agency so that you get to do the exciting parts of your work, but you know, you can like automate or like give away like, or you know, like just like abstract away maybe the not as exciting parts. I think that's a great opportunity that we'll like for years to come. I'm very excited to see how people will keep attacking that problem. I think like, you know, law, like legal research was one of the earliest places to see that. But even like one of our users, for example, is a medical note summarization. They only do medical note summarization. And if you think about it, it's like a very small problem, right? But applied at the scale and then thinking about how overwhelmed our medical system is, like just being able to understand the key points of a patient's background as they come into your, like it's immensely useful, right? So really thinking about like all of the areas where there's like inefficiencies and how AI systems can come and help with that, I think that's actually great. So if you don't work in AI, this is actually a great time to like start a company and think about how AI can kind of help out. I think in terms of like getting up to speed on the latest and greatest in AI, there's so many amazing voices to listen to that do a much better job of this compared to me. One of those folks is like the host of this podcast, Logan. So, you should definitely try to like follow all of these great voices. And like there's a bunch of really great educators. I'm building a course as well with some of them. And, you know, so I think that's the way to kind of like just stay in the know and be up to speed on what the latest and greatest is.
We also always like to ask our guests what their personal tech stack looks like. So again, that could be from a work standpoint, just from a purely automation standpoint, from a your personal life, you know, what are some of the tools that you're currently using right now?
Oh, yeah. Okay, so Copilot is life. I can't live without Copilot. That's a big one, especially. So we are, like I mentioned earlier, we're releasing Guardrails Server tomorrow and we're writing a lot of documentation. And especially for documentation writing, Copilot is fantastic. I also use, an AI chatbot a lot just as like not for almost just like brainstorming. Like I love brainstorming with it. It's like talking to an intelligent person that'll tell me what I'm not, you know, what are my blind spots, what else I should think about, etc. So that I really enjoy using. For the longest time, that was only ChatGPT for me. I think like now Claude, you know, the new Claude chatbot is really fantastic. So I really enjoy using that. I typically have a meeting notes summarizer in my meetings, especially, you know, either customer calls or hiring calls. Meeting notes transcribers tend to be awesome. I use those a lot. Let's see. Oh, yeah. Shout out to MimiBot. So that is MIMI.bot. It's this small functionality that actually one of the Guardrails users built where you can, it's a bot that you add either to Discord or to your Slack channels. And then anytime you share an archive link, like MimiBot starts a thread on your comment and then like summarizes that paper and key points for you. And I use it so much. Like, you know, as somebody who reads a lot of papers, it's so helpful, so useful. So that is probably a big one. Yeah, in terms of my AI stack, I would say those are probably the big ones. Yeah,
I love that. We're gonna have to have a whole separate episode about why you use Copilot and not Cursor, but we'll save that for another thread. Some the Cursor people are turning over in their grave as they hear this.
Maybe get me off the wait list, and then you know I'll
for Cursor. You got anyone can use Cursor. You gotta start using it.
Okay,
10 times better than all the benefit that you're seeing from Copilot, but just like much more thoughtfully done, custom models, they're crushing it. You got to use Cursor.
I'll test it out actually then today. Yeah,
I'm excited. I'm excited for you. It's been the thing that has like gotten me, you know, as someone whose amount of time that I spend coding ebbs and flows on a given month or week or whatever it is. I think it's the thing that continues to pull me back because it's such a magical experience to use Cursor. So I'm excited for you to get to experience that. I need a DM or an email afterwards about how you experience it. But the question we always like to end with is looking into the latter part of 2024 and maybe even slightly beyond, what's something that you're really hoping happens in the AI ecosystem as we close this year out? And also what's something that you're sort of hoping doesn't happen or gets pushed out a little bit farther than the end of the year?
Yeah, I guess what doesn't happen is premature regulation. I think a lot about AI safety. And so, you know, I get asked to give comments on this a lot. And then I think like regulation, I'm somewhere in the middle. I think people in Silicon Valley really hate regulation. And then, you know, other people like are very pro-regulation. I think I'm somewhere in the middle. Some regulation is good, especially for deepfakes. I think it's very hard to argue that we shouldn't have regulation around deepfakes. At the same time, I don't think we understand enough about how AI will be used in different places to like regulate it, you know, at the stage today. So regulating based on model size, I get the proxy. I don't think it's super harmful today, but we really should, you know, we really, really should like wait and understand how this technology is going to impact everybody before we go ahead and regulate. So that's one thing that I hope people exercise caution about. I think one thing that I'm really hoping would happen, I mean, as a classic machine learning person, I have to say like more benchmarks. So I just, you know, there's amazing work in terms of, you know, by a lot of these private AI companies in terms of, you know, new models, et cetera. I really hope that there's a bigger, stronger shift, even with private models, around public benchmarks, better benchmarks that we can all trust and, you know, like look to as guidance on which model to use for which use case, et cetera. There's a lot of conversation about the existing benchmarks being, you know, not as effective because it's unclear how much of the benchmarks have been memorized by especially the super large models that are released all the time, right? So we're a little bit in this like post-benchmark land right now. And that's one thing I'm really looking forward to, where like the existence of benchmarks that we as a community can turn to for guidance.
Do you think, just to quickly talk about this, do you think LMSys has like helped solve that problem kind of?
Yeah, I think LMSys is great. I think LMSys is really fantastic, but there's like this diversity of tasks that you really want to be able to like capture, right? Which like is just missing right now. For what it does, it's really fantastic and very, very well designed, but you just need like so much more measurement that's missing.
Yeah, I agree with you. It seems like that take what LMSys has done and then just like extend it a little bit and like make all the benchmarks like living and like visible and like active, I feel like would go a long way. I feel like all the companies, as they do the different benchmarking, like test in a slightly different way with a slightly different nuance, and like it actually meaningfully changes the outcome of like how those models are represented. So I'm with you.
A lot of eval stuff. Yeah, I was talking to someone and they were like, every time they read a paper and the paper cites a number, they're like, I just don't know if I trust it. Like they said, like, I can't trust it anymore. I just have to run the experiment for myself because so much of it is memorized. And, you know, like, yeah, so I think like we are in this land where we need, like, especially we're in this, like, you know, numbers driven, like statistics are important world, which is what machine learning fundamentally is. So I think we need to kind of like find our roots within benchmarks.
I completely agree. Shreya, this was awesome. I appreciate you coming on and chatting with us. It was a great conversation. I think I concur with Nolan's takeaway that this is a great reminder that safety should be something that people are thinking about, and guardrails is something that people should be thinking about. So good luck on the launch tomorrow. And thanks for chatting with us.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Finding me. Yeah, I really enjoyed, you know, seeing you again, Logan, and meeting you, Nolan. And yeah, looking forward to, you know, all of the cool episodes that you guys are going to put out.